Welcome to the Wonder Women Tech Show, where we highlight, celebrate, and amplify global leaders who are creating impact. We humanize our role models and curate a culture of vulnerability and belonging. This is a show designed to innovate, empower, and ignite. I'm your host, Lisa Mae Brunson. Innovators, it's Lisa Mae Brunson with the Wonder Women Tech Show. And today's guest is a diplomat and foreign service officer who is passionate about building a foreign service that looks like the whole of the United States it represents. Dr. Yolanda Kearney joined the United States Diplomatic Corps as a foreign service officer in 2004. She served as a counselor for public affairs at the U.S. Embassy in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, public affairs officer at the U.S. Mission to Barbados, the Eastern Caribbean, and the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States, public affairs officer at the U.S. Embassy in Jamaica, cultural affairs officer at the U.S. Embassy in the Republic of Cameroon, and economic officer and chief consul at the U.S. Embassy in the Republic of Guinea. She is the recipient of several Department of State Meritus Honor and Superior Honor Awards and the Lois Roth Award for Excellence in Cultural Diplomacy. Dr. Kearney is a proud alumna of Howard University, from which she earned undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral degrees in music history and literature and religious studies. Before joining the Forest Service, she served as a music historian at the United States Library of Congress. Dr. Yolanda Kearney, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
I'm so excited to sit down with a diplomat today. But before we go into how you became a diplomat and all the great things that you're doing for the U.S., I'd love to learn more about your childhood and your roots. Where did you grow up and what was your childhood like?
Thank you so much for asking, because I think people frequently, when you hear a diplomat, you think, oh, they were born sipping tea or something. Nothing could be farther from the truth. I am from a small town in Central Florida. My late father was an AME minister and a third generation funeral director. My mother is an obstetrical nurse and midwife. So I was surrounded by, sciencey people. Most of my siblings, I'm the third of four, three girls and a boy. And so they are all kind of sciencey folks in terms of practitioners, but here came this artsy fartsy kid that was, ran up the rear. But a small town in Central Florida where, it's not too far from Eatonville of Zora Neale Hurston fame. And if you've read any of Zora's books, that kind of folksy, you can almost smell the orange blossoms in the air setting is what I grew up in. It's just a really small town.
Oh my gosh, I smelled and saw what you were describing. I mean, you were so descriptive. I mean, I'm the oldest of five growing up, so I get being part of a brood. So how did you relate to your siblings?
Yeah, we're all very close. My older brother and my late sister were 9 and 10 years older than I am, respectively. Ooh. And then my younger sister is 9 years younger than I am. I like to joke that she was one of those, change of life surprise babies. And so because we are so spread out in age, we just had really wonderful, we had a traditional sibling relationship, of course, but also in some cases they would kind of, my older brother and sister in particular would, tighten me up a little bit in kind of like an auntie or uncle kind of way. So I think I have the same with my younger sister. So it's, for those who have those age gaps with their siblings, I'm sure you can relate.
Well, I can't, because my brothers and sisters are right at the heels of me. So, So I love that you have all of this amazing, you know, and diverse range of interests and expertise. So what did you want to be when you grew up, and what were some of your earliest influences?
Yeah, I was artsy-fartsy right from the beginning. My brother and sister like to joke that I saved my allowance money so that I could buy a cassette tape recording of some Johann Sebastian Bach, right? So I was studying piano, as is the case for many preacher's children. One of my first jobs was playing hymns in church and also at funerals. So I loved music from the beginning, and I wanted to be a performer. I wanted to surround myself in music history. So I thought I would be on the straight and narrow path for that. I was going to research music, and I was going to write these articles. And I did some of that, but I did not see the diplomatic path coming, to be perfectly honest.
It just came and swooped you up.
It did.
So can you share more with us about your educational journey? Like, what did that pathway look like?
Sure. So Howard is something of a... The Howard University is something of a family school, and I was accepted at Howard, but I wasn't sure I was going to go. One of the things that makes Howard so fantastic is having those Black professors of color that can put an experience in perspective. So, for example, I was a French horn player as I was coming up and studying, and I was accepted at a few, you know, not bad music programs, but William Penn, the late William Penn, who was one of the early members of the Chicago Symphony, a Black French horn player who has typical Black person lips, you know, like mine. And so when you're talking about an amateur and having to put your lips on something and figuring out how to make that work, having somebody who understands these lips was really important. But more importantly, having someone who understands people discounting you when you go into an audition, because what are you doing here? You know, Black girl in this classical music world, what are you doing? That was important. Mm-hmm. So I won't say that I could not have received the same technical preparation elsewhere. That may or may not be true. But I will say that all of the other things on the periphery that go into making a person successful by contextualizing their experience, that I could not have received any place but at the Howard University.
Ladies and gentlemen and humans of the world, she was not paid to promote Howard University. And it's so cool because my dentist, who I love very much, she went to Howard U and is always talking about her experiences, just being supported because, you know, in dentistry, there are not many Black people either. So
right. And challenged in love, which I think is also the other thing that's really important. There's just no slacking. There's no, you know, do your little sob story. Oh, I'm a little Black girl from the South. And, you know, my professors are like, so what? So am I. Let me tell you how high this bar is going to be set and how excellent you're going to be. Period. End of discussion.
Oh, wow. And I have to imagine that sort of environment really allows you to, I mean, sets you up for success, for a successful pathway, right?
I believe so.
So you play the French horn. Mm-hmm. Sounds like you played the piano and you were in music mm-hmm. history. And so how did you get involved with the United States Diplomatic Corps? And first of all, what is that? Because, like, you know, you think the military or, you know, the Army or the Navy, but then what is this United States Diplomatic Corps?
Right. I'll take the second part of that question first, because I had the same question initially. What are these people? Who are they? What do they do? So the State Department is the lead policy agency when it comes to international affairs. So at an embassy or a consulate abroad, an embassy is where the ambassador, who is the president's representative, that is where the ambassador is resident. Consulates are other representations that we have in country that aren't in the capital city. So, for example, our embassy in India is in New Delhi, the capital, but we have consulates in Mumbai and Kolkata. So you have this little mini United States government representation in another country. State Department ambassador is at the head of that, so you may have Department of Defense present. DOD is always going to be present in many cases. USAID, CDC, NIH, Treasury, you name it, all pieces and parts of the federal government carrying out whatever our foreign policy objectives are for their respective agencies. So I didn't know anything about that. My first experience with an embassy is probably like most people, being abroad and needing some sort of consular services. So part of what we do, the reason we're in more than 171 countries is because there's no place in the world that an American might not find him or herself in peril. So if you've ever lost your passport, if you've ever, God forbid, gotten sick or arrested when you were abroad, you didn't know it, but you're like, oh no, I need someone to help me. And that someone is the staff of your embassy. So the first time I encountered an embassy, I needed extra pages in my passport. Didn't really think about it. They were very nice, put the pages in, sent me on my way. I had no idea at the time, I was like 19, so no idea at the time that I would end up working in one of those lovely buildings, but that's what it is. So I was happy in my job at the Library of Congress. I was a junior fellow there first, and I was on the staff of the music division. Everything was great. I was living out the dream. Yay, I'm a music historian and at the Library of Congress. Yay, me. So as is the case with almost every agency, the Library of Congress recruits. And so they tapped me and said, hey, will you be on a recruitment panel? And it just so happened that the booth next to me at that recruitment panel was the State Department. And so when I listened to what it was that they do and how great their job was, and particularly in my career track, public diplomacy, where they work with visiting scholars and artists and press and media relations, I was like, you know what? That sounds kind of awesome, actually. And so from there, I kind of sneaked over, took the card of the recruiter, and decided to sit the exam, which is the first step for us. So I sat the Foreign Service Officer test and passed, and went on to the oral assessment and passed, and then presto changeo, I was in the Foreign Service.
I find it fascinating because, you know, so many of us think that we know where we're going. Like, we set ourselves up for, you know, a certain path. We go to school, get our degrees, maybe even go into that field, put our feet, you know, in the water a little bit. And then you go to an event or you get exposed to a new idea or, a new career, and you jump right in, and suddenly, like, no more music. Now you are a Foreign Service officer. So,
well, not no more music. Music is still there. So I was working at the Library of Congress on a exhibit and on an online exhibit and concert series called I Hear America Singing. My specialty happens to be American music, largely after the Civil War and onward. And so I was already working with visiting artists and scholars at the Library of Congress. When I learned I could do the same in an international setting, I was like, oh, wow. So it just seemed like an expansion of what I was already doing. So it wasn't that I put aside necessarily my background. It was just that I didn't know that I could take the arts portion of my background and apply it in an international setting.
See, that's and that's where I'm educated, along with our listeners, because I have no idea you have led an exciting life as a public affairs officer for several countries. So tell us more about your roles and experiences.
Sure. So I remind you all that I'm a recruiter. So if I hear some great feedback, I'm coming for you, because you need to know that the most important thing is that there is a place for you in this conversation about international affairs. That's the first thing. And the second is that, the State Department, we've heard it. We can Google like everybody else, and we know what y'all say about us, that we are pale, male, and Yale, which is true to an extent. But what we're looking for, we're full up with our clones, right? So no more clones. We're looking for a Foreign Service that looks like all of America. And that means bringing all of your authentic selves to the table. However your hair grows out of your head is perfectly fine. Whatever your experiences were, I did not go to Exeter, right, or any of these prep schools. I went to, a school in the metropolis of Sebring in Central Florida. And that's important because my perspective matters in this discussion. But on the public diplomacy side, we tend to be public diplomacy officers tend to be in sort of two tranches. On the first is all the stuff that I've already talked about, our educational and cultural affairs officers focus on visiting scholars and artists. So if you have a Fulbright instructor on your campus, who's, you know, I'm going to be here for 2 years, I'm going to research, and I'm going to instruct you. In every instance, that person, that professor was recruited by, vetted for, interviewed by staff at an embassy in his or her home country, and then sent to the United States to be on your campus to lecture. Same thing for Fulbright international students. And it works both ways. So Fulbright also sends American scholars and lecturers to international settings. So that was the educational part. That was going to be fine. In almost every instance, when you have what used to be called the jazz ambassador, Dizzy Gillespie and the rest, going around the world showing off the excellence that is American artistry, all of that's orchestrated by the State Department. So I fully expected that that was where I was going to spend most of my career, right? I'm a culture girl. It's going to be great. But the other side of the house is information and media relations. So everything that's forward-facing about the embassy, our official website, our social media platforms. Frequently, the public affairs officer serves as the ambassador's primary speechwriter. Everything, and clearly working with journalists. So I have to go to the podium, sort of like Jen Psaki. You expect the worst every day because it's probably coming. But that's their job. There's no animus there. You know, I'm at the podium to answer the questions. They're there to get their questions answered. And, you know, frequently I survive. But what I didn't expect to happen, serving as mission spokesperson, I didn't expect to be as engaged with professionalization of the press corps, because that's a lot of what we do. We spend a lot of time and funds, frankly, helping members of press corps around the world to get stronger so they can do what's necessary. You can't have a functioning and a really vibrant democracy without people having the information they need to make informed decisions. And the truth is, in a lot of the world, journalists take their lives in their hands to do their jobs. We have journalists who are publishing in exile in some cases. On more than one occasion, I have gone to a jail because I'm visiting a journalist who's been arrested or detained. This has largely influenced the places that I've chosen to serve. Guinea-Conakry, Cameroon, DR Congo, those are some of the worst jailers of journalists on the continent. So I did not expect to fall in love with that part of the job, but that's where I am. So I have had the pleasure of going to more than one journalist's wife, and in each instance, it was a man who was detained. But I've had the chance to go to them and say, I know your husband is alive. I know so because I just left the jail. I just spoke with him. And so that kind of really immediate impact, I didn't fully expect to have in this career, but I really enjoyed it. And so the press side of the house is where I've sort of found my niche.
I can imagine that. I mean, just listening to you, I mean, I'm fascinated. I'm drawn in because you don't, you know, we do have a perception of what the U.S. Department of State is, in my case, it's incorrect. And so I stand corrected, and I'm grateful to have this conversation with you because it allows me, and I'm sure anyone else listening, to peel back the veil a bit and really see the work and the impact that's made inside of this organization.
So it is. You know. Before we leave that, I don't want folks to think that, you know, every foreign policy directive and decision that our country has made has been pristine. Part of what I expected to do when I came into the Foreign Service was to sort of be that voice of dissent, right? Part of Howard's alma mater says, make us true and kneel and strong, ever bold to battle wrong. And so I expected, you know, throw in hand to be like, no. What I found in the department, however, was just a group of people who are whip smart, who have a really strong grasp of all the players at the table, right? So other agencies have sort of the luxury of only focusing on what they do. USAID focuses on development, period. That's what they do. DOD focuses on mill-to-mill interactions. That's what they do. CDC is focusing on, you know, whatever's happened with the latest outbreak. State Department is different, though. As the lead policy agency, our job is to sort of take a look at the entire country team, the entire interagency, look at all the equities that are there, figure out what the directive is. Our directive is to do X thing. And with all these equities, all these players at the table, all these agencies at the table, someone has to decide in what direction we're going to move. Now, frequently, our sister agencies will disagree. You know, DOD may not love the way that the State Department's come down on whatever, or USAID, or fill in the blank. But ultimately, somebody has to be the lead when it comes to policy, so that the folks who are more programmatic, USAID, for example, can do the work that they do with some clear direction, so that in country, we don't have several agencies sort of all over the place. There's clear direction. This is how we're going to focus on X issue in this country based on the directives. And someone has to have the final word. That final word is the State Department.
Wow, that's so incredible. I mean, you've received several honors and awards for your service. So what do you feel are the cornerstones for building a strong career in the U.S. Department of State?
I think the first is the same as it would be in any career, which is know thyself, have your red lines. Whatever it is that you feel that you can't or won't do, you need to know that up front in any career, because I promise you, whether it's, you know, Pfizer or fill in the blank or the State Department, if you don't know what your boundaries are, somebody else will define them for you. So that's the first thing. Know what you want and know what your boundaries are. And then from there, I think you'll be able to go on and do whatever's next. The second is, you know, can we be educable? To come in and listen for a minute. I had some very strong opinions about state when I came in. These are all old white males, this is what I thought, who, you know, went to Harvard and, you know, maybe Yale and Princeton, and they're so out of touch with the way that the world works, and how are they making these decisions? And I am pleasantly surprised that whether they, you know, are old white males and went to Howard, some of them went to Harvard, Princeton, Yale, there are a few, whether they did or not, I've just found that they are not nearly as out of touch and unwilling to listen to different perspectives as I expected them to be. Again, I expected to be that agitator in the State Department. And I've played that role from time to time. There have been things that I felt very strongly about in some cases. And the beauty of the State Department is there, we have something called the dissent channel, which is sort of like a dissenting decision on the Supreme Court. The country team meets, the ambassador's gathering information from his entire senior staff or her entire senior staff. And at the end, someone has to make a decision. But the ability to say, I know this is the decision, I know this is the way we're moving forward, but I'm going on the record officially tell you that I disagree, and here's why. I don't know where else you find that. And so for my friends in the corporate world, the answer is nowhere. Because I ask these questions, like, you know, they're making money hand over fist in the corporate world. I've got friends who, I won't pick on Pfizer too much, but I have a couple of friends at Pfizer, they're in investment bankers and whatnot. And so when we have these conversations about how authentic do you get to be at your job? Like, do you get to just say to the person who's in charge, I hear you, we're going to do what you say, but we're going to hash this thing out, and I just flatly don't agree. And what I hear from most of them in the corporate world is, girl, are you crazy? I have mortgages to pay. Being in an environment that welcomes that kind of intellectual debate, the State Department is slow. I keep hearing that. Oh, it's like a sleepy giant. You know, it's slow, but it's slow purposely. We have very focused, deliberative processes because I think you would want that for foreign affairs and international affairs. Absolutely. I don't think you want anybody making any snap decisions. Frankly. So being slow and being deliberate, gathering information before you move and make a decision is something that I've come to, perhaps because I'm older, but it's something that I've come to value more than I did when I was first starting out.
I really love that you talk about the importance of debate and having a difference of opinion. But first, know thyself and listen. And I feel like at the end of the day, that those three takeaways are the most important things you'll probably ever carry with you. As you mentioned earlier, know thyself, listen, and then form an opinion. Disagree if you must, but exactly. Do those things first. And I love that you cultivate that environment, and that the U.S. State Department does as well. You mentioned that you are a recruiter now. So mm-hmm. I'd love to learn more about, you know, what that role looks like for you and your mission to really create a foreign service that represents the whole of the United States. What does that look like?
Yeah. So there are 16 diplomats in residence. We are spread out around the world, around the country, with our various regions. So I represent the DC metro region. I cover DC, West Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware. And so, like, that sounds like a lot of ground to cover, and it is. Most of us spend a day or two a week in each of our states, going from campus to campus in some cases, but also working with alumni associations and professional associations. Not everyone who works with the State Department is on the policy side and a Foreign Service officer like myself. We have Foreign Service specialists. We call them diplomats with special skills. And they, unlike Foreign Service officers who have sort of this broad policy perspective, they come to the Foreign Service with a very narrow portfolio. So, for example, we have medical practitioners. Every embassy has a health unit that can be turned into a surgical suite and a pinch if it needs to be. So the people who help care for us, nurse practitioners, physicians, and others, they clearly have gone to med school. They have their licenses. They have all their certifications. So they are Foreign Service specialists. Our IT professionals that make sure that we can communicate securely any place in the world, especially when it's kind of a game of like whack-a-mole, people who want to listen in on our various conversations. Our IT professionals are amazing. We have office managers who serve as confidential assistants to the ambassador and the deputy chief of mission. That's number two at an embassy. And also they make sure that everything in an embassy is, you know, runs like it's supposed to run. Nothing would happen without them, frankly. We have financial management officers. If you can imagine being in a country where the exchange rate against the U.S. dollar may fluctuate three or four times a day, luckily for me, Yolanda does not have to worry about that. There are amazing accountants who make sure that all of our bills get paid and whatever the prevailing exchange rate was for the day. and also that they account when I'm, you know, out writing grants and working with local organizations, they make sure that they account for everything down to the penny. So all of these things that work internally that make the embassy run. Our general services officers who we have to have someplace to live, right? So somebody has to lease those houses. Our kids have to get to school. Somebody has to make sure that the buses run, all of those things. And our Foreign Service specialists bring that to the table. So we're looking for Foreign Service employees, officers like me who are looking to be policy geeks and wonks, that's fine. But also primarily, really, Foreign Service specialists who can bring those very focused skills to the table and carry out those duties in an international setting. If you know an amazing accountant who's, you know, looking for a new challenge, maybe it's too boring to be in U.S. dollars all the time, I encourage them to think about what that would look like in a cash-only society where the, you know, exchange rate is fluctuating by the hour in some cases. They say they love it. It sounds like cold terror to me, but these are the people that we need.
I'm glad people like them exist because, you know,
exactly.
I would be lost. I find it interesting because there, you know, when I first, we've had the opportunity and the honor to work with the U.S. Department of State for several years now as one of our partners. And in our last summit that we did a virtual summit. One of your representatives that we work with, love her, Seagal. First of all, joined all of our sessions. One of the few partners that actually, I'm not even kidding, folks, like she sat in on every talk and even every workshop. We did a workshop on vulnerability. And I was absolutely impressed, actually, with the level of commitment and participation and real, like actual real interest in learning about our ecosystem and also just sharing the knowledge of opportunities that are you know, available inside the U.S. Department of State. And what I took away from it was just real authentic people at the helm of this space. And you too. I mean, just sitting here talking with you for this first half of our conversation has really been a delight. I'm enjoying this. Well, where can you. I so where can I sign up? Look, I might need a part-time job.
I like it, and I won't call it stalking, but I will tell you that I can be pretty persistent. So for everyone, if you plan to be in touch, just remember I'm looking for a foreign service that looks like America. So yeah, looking at you.
Especially if you're playing the French horn.
That's right.
We're going to take a break for today's Pioneering Women segment.
Today's pioneering woman is Bessie Blunt Griffin. Bessie Blunt Griffin was a nurse, physical therapist, inventor, and forensic scientist. She was born in 1914 in Hickory, Virginia, and was largely self-taught and inventive. She studied to be a physical therapist, and after the end of World War II, she saw that many soldiers returned home as amputees. She watched as they struggled to develop new ways to write, dress, and feed themselves. Bessie created an apparatus to allow amputees to feed themselves with a tube that delivered bite-sized pieces of food directly to their mouths when they bit down on the tube. In 1951, Bessie updated her device with a simpler design. It used a neck brace that provided support for a cup or dish. Unfortunately, the American Veterans Association failed to see the benefit of her invention, and she donated the rights to both her inventions to the French government. She continued to come up with useful inventions, including a disposable emesis basin that was repeatedly ignored by Americans. In 1969, she changed careers and worked as a forensic scientist for police departments. Thank you for your pioneering contributions, Bessie Blunt Griffin.
Hello, innovators. We are back with Dr. Yolanda Kearney talking about creating an impact as a diplomat in foreign service and also figuring out that you can be anything and everything, even with the background in music history. So, Dr. Kearney, what do you feel are the opportunities for people in STEAM industries to develop a career in the U.S. Department of State?
Thank you so much. Well, I'm so happy that you're an organization that uses STEAM. That's the first thing, because I dislike having this arts component as something that's separate. So we have two paths for folks. There are people like me who are on the policy side. So I want to use our economic officers as an example. So, of course, you're thinking econ, this has to mean macro and micro analysis of commercial advocacy. And that's all true. But our econ officers are where you're going to find our ESTH, Environment, Science, Technology, and Health officers. It's a subset of what we do. And we put them there because there's a nexus to the economy with each of those things. So for people who are interested in climate change as a policy issue, this is where you can take your interest and make an impact. For people who, you know, who was having the conversation about 5G? Who was leading that conversation? What does that mean for us exactly? They are our ESTH officers. For people who are really interested in what do I do about making sure that endangered species are going to be around, what do we do to counter animal poaching and animal trafficking? It's there in our econ officers, environment, science, technology, and health officers. And then finally, from a policy perspective, what does it mean to try to contain COVID globally? What does that mean? Mm-hmm. What does it mean in a country where there's an Ebola outbreak or three? What does that mean from a policy perspective, to try to contain an outbreak? So that's where you can take your skills as a policy person. So if you've studied in any of the STEM fields as an undergrad and you're thinking, I could go to a lab, maybe I could do that. But I also am thinking, what does this mean? Like, I want to talk about policy. I want to make sure that we don't have XYZ thing happen again. the way to take those skills and to take your interest really is to look at our economic officers, because that's where you're going to find the STH. For practitioners, we talked about our physicians and whatnot. If you are in a STEM field, you are amazing with your IT skills, and you think that you can help the United States Department of State keep its communications running securely in any setting. I'm sure you're going to be amazing in London, but how would you do in Bangui, right? You like a challenge? Then there's a place for you as a practitioner. So for all of those, we have lab technicians and others. If you, the first thing, again, is back to know yourself, right? I've studied XYZ thing. Now, what do I want to do with that? Do I want to look at policy more broadly, or do I want to be an actual practitioner? Either way, when it comes to the STEAM fields, you can do that in the State Department, including as a music historian. So, right, I want to make sure the next generation of wonderful musicians around the world have an opportunity to share their skills with broader audiences, and to bring visiting scholars and artists to international settings. I don't know that I would have had the opportunity to do that outside of the State Department.
I love this. I'm like ready to sign up if I could have another career. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And most people do, right? So the average age of a new Foreign Service officer is 34.
Oh,
so
really?
Yes.
Well, I've surpassed that. I'm not going to say exactly how much I've surpassed it.
So have I. But you have to be between 21 and 59 and a half to join the Foreign Service. And we have people who come all over the place. So some people do come fresh out of undergrad. That's fine. And they do fine. But we have a lot of people who have this as a second or even third career. Because after get into that know thyself, after you've, and I hear this over and over, I was an investment banker and I was miserable and blah, blah, blah. And I wanted to do something more meaningful. And I this and I that. Yeah, well, here's your opportunity to do something more meaningful. You may have made more money. I'm going to be real honest about the salary. It's a great salary. Don't get me wrong. It may not be an investment banker salary, but the things that you take away, or I'll make I statements, the things that I have taken away from this career, there's no dollar amount that you can put on it. If I can share with you a brief, super brief story. So part of what we do is we look for Fulbrighters to go to the United States, folks who are going to study at the graduate level. I was in Cameroon. We were interviewing Fulbright candidates. And so there was a young man who'd come from the very far north of the country, the portion between Chad and Nigeria. And he'd taken a bus for 3 days to get down to the capital in Yaoundé to interview for Fulbright. And so he was great. I mean, just head and shoulders above all the other candidates. And so I came in to tell him, I was cultural affairs officer, congratulations, we selected you to be a Fulbright finalist. This man fell to his knees and started to weep. And so, and I was very moved, like, oh, it's so great. You know, he's going to be a Fulbrighter. He's really happy about his graduate study. And so when he composed himself, he said, no, you don't understand. These clothes, these are not my clothes. I borrowed these clothes to come here, to this place, to this gleaming embassy that you people have built, to come in here and interview. And my church took up a donation to get me on a bus so that I could ride for 3 days to come to this interview. And when I came into this gleaming building, this embassy that you guys have built, I saw the children of elites. I saw Minister so-and-so's daughter, who was also here to interview. And I thought, forget it. They're never going to take me. And so what you're telling me is that you guys, you said that it's about merit, and I'm nobody. He said, my father is he's a gardener. My father's a gardener. I'm nobody. And so from that moment, there were two things I took away from that. The first was always wear waterproof makeup on the day that you are going to.
I'm like tearing up, and I do not have waterproof makeup on. So that's true.
Always wear waterproof makeup on the day that you're going to speak with Fulbright finalists. You'll have a note to self. The second was that the United States, as complex, complicated, and flawed as we are as a nation, there is nothing at all wrong with our ideals. Our ideals are just above reproach. The carrying out of our ideals, living up to our ideals, is a whole different thing. I feel like it's my job to help push this country towards this more perfect union.
Because what I saw in that moment was a man who was so convinced that the way that things work in his country, if you are not from the right family, from the right ethnic group, it's just not going to happen for you. And with his ill-fitting suit, he said, "You don't understand, I've eaten peanuts." We would stop when the bus would fill up and I had some money and I would buy some peanuts. This man had eaten peanuts for 3 days on the bus to come to take this interview and still had 3 days to get back home for a shot at becoming a Fulbrighter. And so I talk, my son is 13 and I find it analogous, right? So my ideals as a parent are up here, right? I fall short of my ideals as a parent multiple times a day. This does not mean that I'm a crap parent. However, it means that I have a lot of work to do to live up to my ideals. And I really think that as American citizens, as we're having this conversation about what we want this country to look like and demanding that we live up to our ideals, that those two things are not mutually exclusive at all. Our ideals are great where they are. So now the work to do is to make sure that we continue to live up to them and to call it out when we see that we've fallen short, kind of like my son does when he sees that I've fallen short sometimes, you know, multiple times a day to let me know that I have not lived up to where I should be. So those types, we were talking about why people will want to do this. And, you know, the money that you make at Pfizer, my Pfizer friend knows because I'm coming for her, because I think she'd be great in the Foreign Service. The money that you make at Pfizer is great. But what I'm telling you is that there is not, if I gave you a blank check right now and you had to put a dollar amount on what it felt like to tell that man that he was going to the United States as a Fulbrighter, not because he'd found some favor with Yolanda, but because he's freaking amazing and he's brilliant and he merits the opportunity to go. There's not an amount that you can put on that.
I mean, again, with the lack of waterproof makeup, I mean, it's just, I love stories like this and I love hearing passion come through, and you can hear that in you, Dr. Kearney, like your passion and love and heart for this work is absolutely, you know, prevalent here. And that warms my heart. You know, every time I get to sit down in this studio with amazing people like yourself who are leading, you know, pathways for other people like me, right? To have access to opportunity, to, you know, shatter the glass ceiling, to shatter, you know, through doors that were not created for us to walk through, and provide a sense of dignity and purpose. You know, like that man found dignity in a space where he had to take up a plate to manufacture it, right? But he had it all along. And there's so many of us that feel this way, you know, as women, as people of color, as folks who don't have, you know, opportunities for economic equity. Like, we don't have these opportunities, but seeing that that there's pathways that are provided by organizations like the U.S. Department of State and other organizations that are standing in the gap for people like us, I'm just so grateful for that. Yeah. Thank you for your service there.
Well, thank you. But you know what? My thanks to the American taxpayers, because it's we who fund that and fund those opportunities. And it works both ways. I mean, I've had similar conversations with American Fulbrighters who, you know, I've had folks to say, you know, this is my first time out of the country. And I did not think that they would select me to be a Fulbrighter. And, you know, it's that sort of self-doubt. Are you sure? Are you sure you didn't make a mistake picking me? And I'm like, are you kidding? You're fantastic and you're amazing. I don't make those kind of mistakes. Says Eric Allen. I don't make those kind of mistakes. But it's important that they know that that they belong. And this is the battle that we fight, right? To make people understand that you are more than enough. I keep hearing from people who are like, you know, I would apply for the State Department, but I just feel like I need to do fill in the blank thing. I need another degree, or I need to some more experience and blah, blah. I need another internship. And I've had some really frank conversations. Like, can I tell you about the mediocrity that that sometimes surrounds me in events? I need you to understand how great you are right now, right where you are, and that you are more than enough and more than ready to apply. We tend to be, and by we, I mean Black women in particular, folks of color more broadly, we tend to, you know, I gotta be overeducated, I gotta be 15 times better, when in fact, you're more than enough right now.
Oh, I needed that reminder. Thank you. I'm going to write that on my mirror. You know, as we have navigated through a global pandemic and have seen global relations take dramatic turns, you know, you talk about, you know, having people that are consulates or ambassadors in other countries. What do you feel is the impact for someone in foreign countries, you know, to perform diplomatic service in times like these?
Yeah, our diplomatic history, the diplomatic history of the United States, is just littered with mistakes, frankly. And we have documented those. In some cases, we've apologized for those. But again, I have to go back to who was at the table, you know? It's like a bad ad campaign in some cases. You know, if only you'd had some other folks at the table, somebody could have warned you that maybe this is not going to go right. So it works both ways. It's fine to sort of criticize and critique. As a matter of fact, American citizens should. You should be engaged with the government. And where you see or where you believe we've erred, you should let us know. And you should speak loudly, because that's part of a citizen having this relationship with her government. But for people in country, and I'll speak to the places where I've served. Disaster relief and mitigation. DR Congo with 3 Ebola outbreaks in 3 years in 3 different parts of the country. I can only tell you the kind of very heartfelt thanks that I heard and saw from people all the time about, you know, thank you so much for what your country does for us. And just other places that I've served, it when you're talking about the investment that the United States makes in people, and that tends to be the way that we approach our foreign policy. So some other countries might build a stadium, and there's nothing wrong with stadiums. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I like a good soccer game like anybody else. But for some people, some countries, their approach to their engagement in their foreign policy is, you know, we're going to build this stadium, or we're going to, you know, give X number of computers to the government or whatever. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. For the United States, I think we just have a philosophical difference of opinion. Our investments are in people. They tend to be in people and in institutions. So the guy who's going to the United States to study botany, who was amazing, who spent 3 days on a bus, the contributions that he's going to make to his country when he gets back are so beyond like the one-off for the stadium for me. And not that I have anything, you know, I like soccer games. That's all fine. DR Congo, another Congo story. That government was looking at how it was going to mainstream children with disabilities. They were looking at a couple of models and decided to go with the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act. So as the public affairs counselor, that then meant that I was sort of liaison between our Department of Education and the Ministry of Education in country. So picture it, if you will. If you have a child who is blind, mom's first language is Lingala, dad's first language is Kikongo. The language of instruction when that child gets to school is going to be French. What are the best materials for that child? Why are we going to do this in Braille? So our colleagues at USAID were focused on, you know, logistical issues. What are the best materials? What do the best minds tell us about educating a child with that particular disability in that scenario? That's the kind of expertise that we can provide. For me, from a policy standpoint, we were looking at how can we support this government in the way to do the thing that this government has said it wants to do. And that played out in a Fulbright slate that was focused on people who were taking their exchange at Gallaudet, for example, so that when they finish their graduate degrees at Gallaudet and they go back to the Congo, they are not only do they have that information, but now they can become sort of trained trainers. They are set up to become professors at universities in country, which has a multiplier effect that is a whole lot larger than, again, a stadium. We're looking at people who were going to study curriculum, instruction, and design. specifically for people with disabilities, and to give them the opportunity while they're in the United States to be in several settings, because it's easy to say, oh, well, yeah, United States, you have such wonderful infrastructure. That's true, but we're going to take them outside of Washington. We're going to put them in tribal college settings. We're going to also put them in rural settings so that they can see the struggles that we have in the United States similarly. And also for the same child who has a parent who speak two different languages at home, the language of instruction is going to be yet another language when they get to school. Put them in settings, put the instructors in settings so that they understand what it's like to be in a country where we welcome immigrants from everywhere. The New York City school system has, if I'm not mistaken, 167 languages that they're dealing with for immigrant Wow. children who come to the United States that need to get to mastery of English. So all of this is important because it helps countries understand. In that instance, it helps the instructors and those who are writing this curriculum, this national plan, understand that, no, you're not alone. You're not the only country that has these kinds of challenges. Congo has more than 300 languages. And so figuring out how to get all of those kids to mastery in French, which is going to be the language of instruction, is the same sort of challenge that we have when we're trying to get immigrant children to mastery in English. So they're not alone. It's not the first time that a country's had to deal with the same sort of issue. And again, is it bigger than the stadium? You know, is it flashier than the stadium? No. Does it have long-term intergenerational payoffs? Yes. And so, again, we're talking about just a baseline philosophical disagreement about the way that we engage. We tend to focus on institution building and investing in people who have the ability to be just really to have far-reaching impact.
You know, much like that accountant that you have over there, mm-hmm. I am so glad that there's people like you navigating through these real human challenges, these yeah. global challenges that the regular person like myself, who is still doing a lot in the world, but has no mm-hmm. idea. None that things like this, that programs like this, that initiatives like this are taking place. And, you know, again, it's peeling back that curtain to take a peek at really what work we actually do.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a country.
Yeah. Our colleagues in USAID, CDC, NIH, I'm thinking about the three Ebola outbreaks in Congo. The first two were very swiftly contained. The third was much more problematic because it was in an area of the country that where there were several militias present. So what do you do when you have an outbreak where it's unsafe to go there? Now what? How is that going to work? So I'm talking about folks who were working with organizations like Translators Without Borders. We were, which I didn't even know existed until that outbreak came, to help people understand protocols for staying safe in the Ebola outbreak in the languages that they understand. We were putting together, working with student groups to create skits and songs so that people understood exactly how they can keep themselves safe. That's the kind of work that I just find incredibly rewarding. Again, not as sexy as the soccer stadium.
That poor stadium.
You're beautiful. Don't get me wrong. and again, you know, it's just a difference of approach. It's a difference of approach when it comes to international affairs and foreign relations. Some countries just go about it differently. And which is not to say that there's not a place for all of it at the table with a particular, the foreign policy, the foreign policy dealings of a nation. You know, what you do with China, what you do with, you know, fill in the blank is cool. And whatever works for you, works for you. Show me a country that does not operate in its own best interest. It's just important that people know, I think most importantly, that American citizens know what your government does and how your government thinks about investments in country and how best to attack a particular issue in a way that isn't keeping with our values.
Yeah. I feel like I'm like educated right now.
What?
This has been amazing. You know, I imagine that you've gone through your fair share of challenges, as we all have. So can you share with us how you handle challenges and what do you do to create balance?
Yeah. I've had 4 evacuations in my career. And in each case, I stayed as essential staff. So I've put my family on planes and stayed. And that is incredibly hard. I mean, that's another day when you definitely need your waterproof makeup. When you see them fly off, that's hard. So I think there are a couple of things that Foreign Service officers tend to do. The first is to remind yourself why you're doing this thing. My son has missed a couple of these. Missed, you know, his grandmother's birthday. I missed my high school reunion. Although I was pretty happy to miss that one. And so when you're missing these things, because there are going to be some things that you miss, right?
Yeah.
When you're missing these things, and especially for me, putting it in perspective for my son, why are we doing this? Why are your dad and I doing this? Why do we have you doing X, Y, Z thing? And I'm able to tell him, you know, those kids that we saw on the street, and we're working with a grantee that's going to be able to do such and such thing for them. So I think for Foreign Service kids, they tend to be worldly because they have to be. We pick them up and move them around the world every 2 to 3 years. And they just have an awareness of the structure of government and the way the world works that other kids don't. So the first thing is just back to know thyself. Remember why you're doing this and to be able to articulate it for yourself. Why am I doing this and how does it matter? The other is just, you know, whatever your favorite thing is. I am a Perry Mason junkie. I can say that out loud, right? It's just so over the top. The acting is ridiculous. You know, the scripts were also ridiculous, but I'm there for it because I love it. So whatever your Star Trek 2, like however you unwind, whatever books you read, I love James Baldwin, you know, pull some Baldwin off the shelf. However it is that you find time for yourself to do that and to remember to do that, because that's really important. You cannot pour from an empty cup. And in the State Department, we are very focused on making sure that you keep yourself together. So in a crisis situation, you're going to be there for, you know, your 4, 6, 8 hour shift. And then we sort of hot desk it. At the end of that shift, get up and get out, because you need to go home and sleep and recharge, so that you can come back and be ready to do this next thing. Whatever you were doing, stop doing it, because here's the person who's going to believe you. Shut up, get up, and go, so that you don't drain yourself. And I think that's important. I don't care what the job is. It doesn't have to be a crisis. It's just our everyday living life and carrying out. So the stuff that makes you happy, whatever helps you unwind, don't forget to do that. But more importantly, don't forget why you're doing it. If your job, you know, at the end of the day, if all you have is the money that your job is giving you and it's soul sucking, I submit to you that it might be time for you to think about doing something else. Honestly.
Amen. Yeah. Amen. Amen. Oh. I hear you collect art glass pieces. So when did you develop that interest, and what are some of your favorite pieces and artists?
When I was a small child, my mother and my dad both had quite a large set of family silver. Both of their parents and grandparents had given them silver. And so a lot of it is art deco. So there would be silver with some glass in it. The silver was beautiful, but I always loved the glass, like, you know, milk glass and all of these, you know, you may have seen your grandmother, your great grandmother stuff that's sort of cut glass. I loved it. You know, I loved the prisms and whatnot. And so as I got older, American glass art really was a thing for me. So Josh Simpson is one of my favorites. His wife is an astronaut. She's actually taken a couple of his pieces into space with her. Of course, Dale Chihuly. I wish I had money for Chihuly. Chihuly, if you hear this,
yeah.
If anybody knows Chihuly and they feel like they want to buy me a piece, that would be great. there's an American artist, a young American artist named Chloe Denver, I have several of her pieces. So I like things that sort of speak to me. There's no rhyme or reason to it, but I've taken my glass with me around the world. And so, again, I'm a cultural girl. So we've done some mini exhibits on things that I have in my collection. And it's always interesting because I did not know that there was an art glass scene in the Congo until I started talking with people. And they're doing some amazing work in glass there.
That's so cool. Because I think there was like a whole, I'm trying to remember, in Oklahoma or Arkansas was Dale Chihuly's. There was an exhibit or a Dallas. I can't remember. It's somewhere where one of my family members live. Yeah. There was like this whole portal of Chihuly glass. And then I read about him and I was like, it was just stunning. Like you literally walk through these hallways of just this beautiful, colorful glass.
Yeah. Yeah. I love his stuff. Again, anyone out there who, you know, you wanna think about adding to the collection, I'm happy to, yeah.
I love that. Hey, what are we here for if not to get our shout outs out, right? So, you know, at Wonder Women Tech, we honor vulnerability as a strength. And I love that you've been able to share with us so openly. Can you share something real with us that you've never shared with anyone else before?
Yeah, I'm a pretty open book, so I don't know that it's something that I've never shared before. And I think this is not unique to me. My greatest fear is failing my son. He's an only, his only child for me and his dad, and his dad is a UN diplomat, so that's as complicated as you might imagine. With all of this, there may be a lot of this is personality driven, right? So when you are assigned to a country in the Foreign Service, you know, there may be 5 or 6 really wonderful candidates who would be the perfect person to be the public affairs counselor in X country at that time, in that country's history, in our bilateral relationship. Maybe there were 4 or 5 excellent candidates who would just have been perfect as the diplomat in residence for DC Metro at this time. That's all true. But there's only one person who is the perfect and only candidate to be my son's mother. And that's me. So despite what he says about me, you know, falling short of my values from time to time. So for me, the biggest issue is for all the stuff that we get to do, and he's having amazing life experiences. I have to tell you about the time when, you know, his classmates got invited to the palace because this is in Congo. The president's son was in his class. So the kids got invited to the palace while the parents were outside looking inside, right? Or, you know, looking through the gates. Those are amazing experiences. Wow. All that's great. But none of that matters if at the end of all of it, I failed in some way as his mom. So I spend a lot of time thinking about balance, about how much is too much. Coming out of Congo with 3 evacuations in 3 years, it was incredibly really, really disruptive for him school-wise and just life-wise. And so my next tour I knew needed to be something that was closer to normal, normal for the rest of the world. And if you look at my tours, it's been kind of like that. After a really intense tour in Cameroon, I did 2 tours back to back in the Caribbean. My mother also had brain surgery twice. So, and I'm from Florida. Wow. So being in the Caribbean, yeah, she's amazing. Being in the Caribbean for 2 tours meant that I was close enough to Florida that I could, you know, get home easily if I needed to. So again, it's all about balance. I want to work with journalists who have found themselves detained and in jail, but I can't do anything for anyone if I crumble, and I can't do anything for my family if I'm not fully available. So my biggest concern is not being enough and giving my son the balance that he needs to be the whole person that he's growing up to be. And I have to say, I'm enjoying him more as he gets older and older. He's quite witty. For every parent, as you see your child's personality start to develop, it's really quite something. And so I just want to make sure that I'm doing everything that I need to give him everything that he needs to be the wonderful person that I think is developing in there. I live on Capitol Hill, so if we hear a siren, this weekend is the J6 rally, so there's been quite a lot of there. I'm surprised we didn't get a siren earlier than that.
Well, you know, that actually is kind of a perfect like moment where it's like, you know, you're sharing openly with us about creating a safe environment for your son. And, you know, something that I observed throughout our conversation actually was that you did reference your son a lot throughout the conversation. And yeah. You could see that you have this very real deep sense of responsibility and love, and nurture, you know, a nurture environment that you want to provide for him. I noticed that moment one. So the fact that you're leading with that as something that, you know, is your vulnerable share makes so much sense to me. And I admire you for that. You know, thank you for being open with us. And I'm sure, you know, I'm the oldest of five growing up and six total. And I don't have children, but to me, the world is my children. And I can't imagine being responsible for a single person scares me more than being responsible for a whole bunch of people. So I commend you on that. And I'm sure you're an amazing, amazing mother, because you really are an amazing woman. I've been just really moved by our conversation.
Thank you. It takes one to know one, so I greatly appreciate it. Aww. And I'm going to take that to the bank. You know, when I try to, as his parents, we both try to create a really open environment for him, especially when it comes to bidding, where are we going next? What about the school? Such and such and so. So we try really hard to listen to him and what he, his concerns. But it really is kind of key to make sure that you are, that we just stay grounded. I'll leave it at that. That we all stay grounded.
Absolutely. You've created a life that is filled with global experiences and diplomacy and some hard decisions, as you've just shared with us. If you had to do it all over again, would you take the easy road or the road less traveled, and why?
Yeah. I'm kind of a nomad. And so I think the road less traveled. It's always been this way since my childhood. Luckily, my mother's not here to provide commentary. But I'm always wondering, what's behind that door? And I think for anyone thinking about the Foreign Service, you have to kind of have that stripe. What are those people doing? And how are they living life in X place? And what every diplomat will tell you is that we have so much more in common than things that separate us, no matter where in the world you might be. I mean, it's the same sort of very, very human baseline experience. And once I wish more Americans would travel, frankly. I wish more folks had their passports. I wish they would just, step outside of this bubble for a moment and just see how the rest of the world is living. It's quite something. And then be shocked at how similar we all are. So I think it would be road less traveled.
I couldn't agree more. I love traveling. I think it's my favorite thing to do on the planet, and it has provided me such a perspective, an opportunity for thinking outside of the box and shattering preconceived notions and unconscious and conscious biases than anything else that I could possibly use to educate myself. Traveling and just being exposed to new ideas and new people and cultures are just, it's paramount.
Very much so.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kearney, for hanging out with me today, for dropping some amazing gems, and for allowing me to really understand that diplomacy does ignite prosperity. And I appreciate you just being so real. This was awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And thanks for the work that you do. I don't know that we say it often enough, but folks are out here making sure that people understand their full potential, and then not just understand that potential, but giving them the tools to live up to that potential. We need so much more of that. So thank you for the work you do.
Oh, thank you. And I'm going to take that to the bank.
Thank you so much for being here, innovators. Make sure you give us a like and share the podcast with your network. We'll see you next week when we take on the world one more time.